Outreach in Ghent. Next to him, we have Dr. Mary Dell Chilton, who is the founder and distinguished science fellow at Syngenta Biotechnology. And last but not least, we have Dr. Robert Fraley, who is the chief technology officer at Monsanto. So with that, I think we might start off with just a quick question to the laureates to start things off. Maybe talking a little bit about kind of what you see as the most important things that need communicated about biotechnology, and then we will open it up to some questions.
You're done.
Want me to start?
Okay, well.
What do we need to communicate about biotechnology? I think probably the main message is its safety. The fact that no problems have ever been recorded since the first biotech seeds were launched. It works in the field, or the farmer would not be buying it. So those qualities certainly it should sell itself if it could.
Yeah, we go. Well, it's also the urgent need. People think that we, living in the States or in Europe, we have it so well off, and we forget all what we see in our televisions on the hunger in the world, on the dramas that occur in so many rural areas all over. People forget that half of population lives with less than $2 a day, and that hunger and poverty and damage to the environment, that's all one story, and it's science and technology that has to take it up.
I absolutely agree with Mark. I think the challenge we face over the next 37 years to double food production, to feed the 9.6 billion people who will be with us in 2050 is an absolutely daunting task, but I think we can do it with these new tools. And it's absolutely important that we have a dialogue and an understanding and a trust with folks around the world so that that technology can have the impact that, that we so much need from it.
So with that, are there questions for the laureates?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm Larry Brown from High Plains Journal. This is directed to Dr. Fraley, by the way. It seems that even though there's so many other companies out there that produce products using biotech materials, yours seems to be the one that gets focused more than any by the anti-biotechnology crowd. Why is it? Maybe Dr. Chilton could possibly get into it, since that's her bailiwick in another company, that you can have all these different, one company gets focused and another doesn't. What do you think, what gives?
I'm willing to share, Mary Dell. but, sometimes that's frustrating, I always assume that means we've been really successful and effective, and people, see us as a leader, and that's okay. I think that's part of the responsibility that goes with it. I think when I step back and think about it, I mean, I always have two reactions. I mean, if you would have told me back in 1981 that we'd be sitting here today, talking about a science and a technology here at the World Food Prize that has now reached tens of millions of farmers in 30 countries. It's probably the most rapidly adopted new technology in the history of the agriculture. I probably wouldn't have believed it. And on the other hand, 30 years ago when we were first starting, I don't think I would have expected, some of the concerns and issues that we deal with today.
No, nor did I. I think none of us... None of us imagine how rapidly the technology would be adopted. Why one company is targeted and another not, I don't know an answer to your direct question. I think we need to have good communications with the public about the safety of what we make.
I think what's really what you're seeing now is, I think companies, and I can tell you Monsanto would be, absolutely... I'd start with us is, I think what made us successful and why we reached so many farmers is we had a focus on farmers, and that's been a key part of the adoption of the technology. I think, you know, as we've done more listening and we've done a lot of dialogues with consumers and consumer groups and folks who like and don't like our technology, I think one of the things that we get as a feedback is that the world doesn't see us as a seed company. The world sees us as the first step in the food chain. And we and our whole industry just has not done a very good job of reaching out to consumers. And that's something we need to do and do very differently. And I think it means different approaches, different use of social media, an increased level of transparency, and all the things that go with earning the support and trust of consumers.
I have one more point to add to this, and that is that the initial products that BioTek made were the ones that were feasible. They were single genes put into the plant, and they made a dramatic change in the character of the plant. And these were changes that the farmer could appreciate. They were not changes that the end user would appreciate, except at the point of the price of the goods that are made. So I think in the future we are at a place in the technology where we can change more biological traits that affect the quality of the crop, of the end product. These will be traits that the consumer can appreciate, and I think they will change the nutrition of the crop plant, for one, such as golden rice. And I think that'll help to sell the technology to the consumer.
My name is Luc van Kemenade. I'm a journalist from the Netherlands. I was wondering, in Europe, we are known to be quite conservative, politically at least, towards biotechnologies. And I was wondering, Mr. Mark van Montagu, how do you feel about that coming from Belgium? And the others can respond as well.
Well, I think in Europe, since you know it very well, it's extremely heterogeneous. The UK is reacting now suddenly differently because they realize it's needed. We in the northern part of Belgium didn't have too much problems with political concern. But going back to the first question, it's a one story. And I really think that we have to be a bit more aggressive. It's, they tried to single out a given billion, Monsanto, but because they know it's people who bring disinformation. And this disinformation would not work if you say industry at large or a big multinational, because people would not listen. But if you start gossiping about a person, people always start believing gossips. That's just your humanity is like that, or neurobiology works like that. It's very strange. We have to come to single out what that is. And there is a lot of our way of thinking and believing is that suddenly comes up when in this GMO story. So finally, in Europe, if Europe is blocked because also there is not a product that people see. It's only some products on large intensive agriculture. Most of the small countries, we have small farmers that make more horticulture sometimes than or grow small amounts. So for the potatoes that touch them, we have solutions with the disease, the transgenics that are transgenic potatoes that are protecting against the fungus that give the potato disease, if that would come on the market. But they have very clever systems worked out. The people who bring this information, they forced lawmakers to make rules that it's so expensive and so time-consuming to bring it to the market that you cannot have a small seed company to take it up. And universities or the public sector is not there for making products. It's the private industry. So it's a very clever way how everything has been paralyzed. And we have to analyze that and do it and then unite and react.
So in maybe other words, does that come down to not being able to communicate the message well enough?
We did not realize how emotional the message was and how easily super lies like Seralini and disinformation that has been spread that touches persons, and they believe this super disinformation. From a rational point, you never could. We thought as soon as you see the tumors on the rats that Seralini showed, no, he's so overdoing it that it will be clear that that it is nonsense, and so the people will change. No, people believe Seralini because they have fear. That's the, and that of course isn't it? You could call it an error, but just call it an error in communication is. I don't think you pointed out very rightly. We have to say that that we are under a systematic attack, and that is unacceptable for a society, and that the society as a whole has to react, and that our political leaders have to take up their responsibilities.
Hello, I work for German radio, and I have a question for Dr. Fraley. First, what does make you optimistic that your company, Monsanto, can do a lot in the future to fight poverty and hunger in the world? And then what would you answer, this is my second question, what would you answer to critiques that sometimes say, well, your company basically does a very clever marketing strategy and wants to make a lot of farmers all over the world dependent on your products.
Good. Let me start with the latter one, because I guess if there's, I'm really excited about the progress in science and the importance of that science going forward. And I understand people have different points of view on technology, particularly around food and agriculture. But there's two areas that I am so proud of that the science has accomplished beyond the acres and beyond the numbers that I think are just worth pointing out to. And I'll answer your question in that point. The two rumors that hurt me the worst that really I had to understand is when you hear educated people and educated reporters talking about food safety, the safety of GMOs. There have been so many thousands of studies that have been performed by regulatory bodies around the world. And then re-reviewed both by the EU, by the National Academy. There was just a big paper that came out from researchers in Italy that basically have absolutely unequivocally pointed out the inherent safety of the technology. There is no truth to all of these stories and rumors regarding any safety impacts of the technology. And just to draw that to a close, these products now, I mean, the first recombinant DNA experiments were done in the 70s. The first transgenic plants that, Mary Dell and Mark and I created were done in the 80s. The products have been in the marketplace for 20 years around the world, and there has not been a single food or feed safety issue ever attributed to this technology. Its track record for safety is absolutely impeccable, and be happy to share any information on that anybody here needs or would like. The second one that I guess, what I'm so proud of is, this technology started in 96 in the U.S. By 98 and 99, this technology was already moving around the globe. And the important perspective that I have on this, I grew up on a farm. I can remember my dad and the neighbors, spending days thinking about which seed, how much, what decision am I going to make, because that's very important. And my experience is farmers are really smart businessmen. I just walked over here from a session where an African woman was talking about exactly the same thing, just how much effort she puts into understanding all the inputs to their farm. So farmers are really, really smart. So the idea that some company is going to sell them products that don't work, that they're going to come back and buy year after year because they don't work and they don't create value, is just sheer nuts. Farmers
are not only smart business people, but they are the stewards of their land. And they're going to make those decisions that improve the sustainability and the livelihood of their operations. And the reason this technology has been adopted so much by farmers is because it works. It improves their yields, it improves their profits, and it makes farming easier.
Hi, I'm Carrie Gillum with Reuters. This is for Dr. Fraley.
Hey,
Carrie. Hi. I actually have three questions.
No,
I don't know.
You're going to have to write these down.
Two are pretty simple. The first one that might take more time to answer, some of the critics of GMO and use of genetically modified crops in agriculture speak to what they feel is heavier intensified chemical use, particularly with herbicide-resistant crops. There's some concerns being raised now about pest resistance. I wonder, first of all, if you can tell me if you think that that's a valid concern, and then if you could talk a bit about what Monsanto's doing in that regard. I know you have some new technology coming out, but you've also talked a bit about biologics and microorganisms, and I'm wondering
sure.
if that plays
yeah,
in as well.
Great. So again, just like on the safety, There's studies and reports that are out there that have been reviewed and peer reviewed. I think just as a soundbite number, if you take a look at biotech crop acres versus non-biotech crop acres, comparing cotton to cotton and corn to corn and beans to beans, on average a biotech acre uses between 20 and 25% less chemical inputs from pesticides than a non-biotech acre, and it's a dramatic reduction in both insecticide use and in herbicide use for those crops, and that's really both an economical benefit. It's also a benefit in terms of reduced spray applications. Every time you have to drive that tractor or walk that field, that's either labor intensive or it's using energy, and so that's all been part of the calculations, and it's one of the reasons that this technology has been adopted so dramatically, as it provides for convenience and cost reductions along the way. So I think that's a key benefit. And clear to the second part of your question, and we talked about it. And I gave a lecture this morning on climate change, and one of the challenges that we will see in agriculture and makes that goal of doubling food production by 2050 again so challenging is we're going to have to do it in the face of a dramatically changing environment. And one of the complications I think we'll see from environment change and temperature changes is we're going to continue to see rapid evolvement of pests and weeds. Having these tools is going to be really critical as we anticipate just a few degrees changes in temperatures can change the hatch time for insects or the onset of diseases. And that's one of the reasons that these tools, I think, are going to be so critical, because we're going to continue to see weeds evolve and insects evolve and diseases evolve, and we want to have all the tools that we can to help mitigate.
Can I just ask my question?
Sure.
Is there any update on the wheat where was it? Oregon. I wrote about it. I can't remember. Is there any update?
The fact that you can't remember tells me that there hasn't been.
Then I'm getting old.
It's been great. It's been I would say that whole issue in Oregon, at some point it'll be looked at, I think, as a great case study on the interaction of the government and the universities and the companies. Within literally a few weeks. All of the seed supply and grain supply had been analyzed, and methods and techniques were made available to import countries around the world. And the USDA is still, I think, completing their report. My guess is there'll probably be, from what I've heard, done before the end of the year. And their conclusion is, that was isolated to that single incident of that field in Oregon. And the really, really good news is that the farmers in the Northwest have completely, harvested all their wheat. All that wheat has been shipped, and there's not been a single issue, not a single example of a boat being redirected or a shipment being lost. We've had absolutely continuity of the marketplace. Thanks.
Last question, sorry. Washington State, how concerned are you that that initiative might pass, 522?
Well, you know, on the labeling conversation, you know, it's a big one. So let me take just a couple of minutes. I know Mark and Mary Dell would want to comment on it. I always like to start the labeling conversation with, and it always surprises a lot of people, our company is absolutely supportive of voluntary labeling. That means if a company wants to source GMO-free ingredients and put a GMO-free sticker on their products, we would be delighted to see that happen. And you know, we're seeing, you know, effectively that's what an organic label is on foods. It's a non-GMO source. If there's anything I could wave my magic wand on, it would be that the FDA would actually authorize a GMO label and create a standard one. You know, they've done that literally a few months ago in beef, where there's now a GMO-free label in beef that has all the standards in terms of animal feeding requirements to get that label. I think that would create a lot of confusion. So then people ask, well what's going actually on in Washington State, or what's going on in California before that, and why wouldn't voluntary labels that any company could put on their products meet the needs of consumer information and right to know? And I guess I'll just, you know, what's going on here is this isn't necessarily about the consumer's right to know. This is about a effort, you know, that's being funded by a certain group to put mandatory labels that would be required, that would, on that panel of food, when you see the label, it has things like fats and calories and saturated fats and unsaturated fats. These are things that, from a health perspective, alert consumers if they have health concerns. And to have biotechnology, which we've just talked about, in 20 years has not had a single food or feed safety issue, be labeled negatively, and an implication that there would be a health issue associated with it, doesn't make any scientific sense. And the people who are pushing that are doing it just for that reason. And it's something that we oppose. I mean, we absolutely support the consumer's right to know. We absolutely support companies' rights for voluntary labels. But we can't support misleading labels that infer that there's something unsafe about biotech products.
Dr. Van Montague or Dr. Chilton?
Well, I surely agree, because in Europe we have seen that was the way it started in the early 90s, by saying democracy asks that you label it in the GM. And that's just a misconception. It was a way to diabolize the GM and to frighten people. You can inform by this label if people think it's interesting that something contains GMs or give some information, but not mandatory, because it's that would be have the start of a whole feeling that arises in the community, and it would be forcing to have an opinion, and instead of making people have the free choice of opinion.
Yeah, my feeling about this is that we have the organic produce now that is known to be GMO-free because of the rules. And what more do we need than that? If a consumer chooses to eat non-GMO food, he has that choice. But I want to keep my choice to eat GMO food if I want. If we start having compulsive labeling, many companies will be unable to produce the GM products that they do now because of concerns about whether it's going to be in some product and run into a labeling problem. So I think it'll be the death of the technology in a real sense if we have obligatory labeling. I'm totally opposed to it.
How difficult would it be to come up with an analysis from a packaged food standpoint? You have a box of rice-a-roni or the pasta with little broccoli pieces in it. How would you ascertain whether or not any single ingredient in that box might have had its origin in a product that was genetically modified.
Well, the food companies that produce their foods, you know, source the specifications, and you know, they take those sources down literally to individual fields and ingredients. So the companies who do label their products as GMO-free have already you know, laid out the path for achieving that. Yep. Thanks.
Kind of goes back to the bigger picture of if we start to limit choices, what does that mean for the world in general? And we've seen a lot of food crops, you know, we hear about citrus greening and products that are direct food. You know, a lot of our corn and soybeans don't directly go into, you can't buy a field corn at the grocery store, but you could buy an orange that would have biotechnology. What do we need to overcome of that debate to see actual biotechnology in food that we would actually buy at the grocery store?
Well, I think it's great that you raised the question, and I think that's really, for me, you know, being a recipient of the World Food Prize this year. I mean, it's you know, it's cool personally to be recognized, but it's just such a great opportunity. It's such a wonderful forum to reset the discussion and have that discussion that we need to have, because I think now, after 20 years and no safety and 20 years and farmers around the world benefiting it, I think the question becomes, what else do we need to do? And particularly when you put it in the context of, you know, 9.6 billion people, a doubling in the food supply, the planet having to produce more food by 2050 than it has in its entire history. I mean, you know, Ambassador Quinn, you know, labels this as the greatest challenge the world faces. And I can tell you, I am optimistic that the tools that we have in biotechnology are incredible, and we're seeing new genes, and we're still seeing, really, from a science perspective, the tip of the iceberg in terms of new opportunities. The other thing I always like to mention, and a lot of people don't appreciate, is these very same biotech tools have completely changed plant breeding. I mean, starting 5 or 6 years ago, when every single gene in a corn plant or a tomato plant or a rice plant was sequenced, it suddenly gave breeders a completely new set of tools to breed faster, to breed more precisely, and that's changing the game from a plant breeding perspective. And right now we're seeing all those advances in biology come together with the advances in information technology. You know, whether it's being able to send to a small farmer in India a cell phone message that gives them the information that the wind currents are changing and there may be a flight of moths that will come in that will lay their eggs and cause caterpillar damage, or it's going to be, information sent to a tractor on a planter in Iowa that says, change the way that this field is planted every 10 meters to optimize yield. And this science is got so much potential that I think the challenge becomes, are we going to limit it by policy and regulation? And, you know, Mark would tell you that we've already seen a lot of limitation because, you know, for us to get a biotech approval for a corn product in the U.S., I always like to tell the story this way. If I were the head of research for a drug company and I wanted to get my drug approved to sell in the U.S., I would get FDA approval. But as head of research for a seed company, if I want to sell a new biotech corn seed in the U.S., I get EPA, FDA, and USDA approval. And then because the corn is shipped to about 20 major export markets around the world, the ministries of health, environment, in each of those countries grants an approval. So we get 30 approvals, and that's why everybody concludes this is the most thoroughly studied and the safest food ever produced by man. But it also costs about $150 million of regulatory work to achieve that, and that makes it hard to get to the smaller crops and probably some of the most important crops from a smallholder perspective.
Hello, Alan Coslow from here in Des Moines. Leaving this politics for a second and getting to the science, I'm curious about two things. One, 30%+ of the food supply is spoiling. What's being done for extending shelf life of products from a GMO point of view? And then the other question is using viral vectors post-planted, you know, doing GMO basically in the field using viral vectors. Is there any work being done on that, and is there any use for that type of technology?
Mark, if you want to grab any of those, go ahead, or Mary Dell.
No.
I just start with a comment on, you know, absolutely, preserving, preventing crop losses is key, and that's, kind of coming back to it. That's why, the universal adoption of bug and weed technology has been so important, because weeds, compete with crops for sunlight and moisture and contaminate grains, and bugs create damage, and part of the damage you're talking about is insect damage on crops. So if you can continue to address those pest challenges as they evolve, that's one of the key ways of helping to address food security and preservation. I think also, clearly, the easy answers to this is refrigeration, and a lot of technologies on shipment and transportation that are now being adopted around the world to help on storage. There's some cool science, and there's a lot of understanding of the genes that are involved in ripening that can be addressed. That there are research projects on that I think could also be helpful. And then maybe to the last point, we're using a technology that we call BioDirect that can do many of the things that you were talking about in terms of, post-plant applications that involves RNAi-type technologies that looks really cool. It could be a really could be an exciting advance. And I think all of these things that one of the important things to keep in mind, myself and Mary Dell and Mark are so closely associated with biotech and GMOs that the important thing to remember is that's just one part of the story. I mean, the application of these tools to breeding has been game-changing for plant breeders, and the application of the biotech tools for diagnostic systems as well as for other types of biological treatments are going to be spectacular in the future. I mean, in many ways, we've moved beyond just the pure biotech and GMOs with some of the new technology platforms.
And that will help to feed the world. I'm sure that will.
I think you are right to come back to science, because most people don't realize how recent our knowledge in plant science is. It's thanks to the GM technology that we could have a lot of basic questions and then suddenly understand the genome, and the sequences helped us, and we had done what we call a little step. But so much more can be done. If you ask about how fungus destroy food afterwards during storage, well, we have to know. A few people worked on these molds by themselves. And the all action against GMOs in Europe at some universities, in Austria and other countries in the south, in Greece and some places in Italy, if you at the university you do a grant application where GMOs would be used, it's refused. You cannot even do it. And that's the dramatic issues that are coming up, because indeed there are so many solutions. The spreading that was said with small RNAs came because all the recombinant DNA techniques made us understand that suddenly RNA is not only an intermediate between the protein and the product and the genes that are there. It's much, much more, and a much interesting regulation. And we will badly need it for our forestry, because you cannot say that you will make the transgenic trees later. The trees are there, 100 years trees. You want to protect them. And if you would know the diseases, the insect diseases, the virus diseases that come up, and you could spray with RNAs of small peptides that's specially geared to them, then you would really bring a solution. And scientists have a whole list of for Santa Claus what they want to, where they work on it. And they hope that society let them do it. And then we will see the progress.
One of the really exciting areas that we're just starting to explore with that RNAi-based approach relates to bee health.
What's the vector getting the
mRNA? We're basically able to do it with the same type of adjuvants and surfactants that you would typically use in crop agriculture. And enough of the RNAi can enter the plant to elicit the biological effect. Well, but I think you know, it's really exciting. It's still early days, but you know, we're able to demonstrate you know, control of insects and disease. And one of the areas that I was just going to mention that I think is particularly intriguing relates to bee health. I'm sure you've heard that there's a challenge with bee health. There's a disease of the hives called colony collapse disorder, and there's, you know, over the 15 or 20 years this has been studied, there's been a lot of different theories as to what's going on, but I think the prevailing scientific, you know, thought today and is that the bees get infected by a mite. And the mite is a carrier for several different viruses. So it becomes a really complex question of how do you control the mite and the viruses. And we think that, and we have evidence that sometimes the application of these RNAis in the hive targeted against the virus or the mite could be a very precise solution to eliminate these parasites of the bees.
Do you have a question?
It's Philip Brash with the Congressional Quarterly. I wanted to follow up on that. There are also some other technology tools in the works. How important is it how regulators view, for example, RNA interference, to what extent they regulate it? How do you anticipate dealing with, given what you've learned with transgenics and all the mm-hmm. issues that you've had with that, what have you learned from that you can apply going forward with these new technologies as they develop?
Great question. There's been a number of scientific conferences and papers written. You know, there's been a lot of work on RNAi in the pharmaceutical world. And the beauty of RNAi, we call it BioDirect, is that these are naturally occurring molecules. We all have RNAis in all of our bodies. They're in all plants. They're in all living organisms. So they're naturally occurring biological molecules. The path today, both in the U.S. and Europe, is they would be regulated as biochemical molecules, much like you would regulate a new microbial strain or a new biochemical agent that would be used for pest or disease control.
Yes, back here.
Hi, I'm from the National Catholic Reporter. Something that our readers are concerned about are poor farmers. And one of the issues with the GM crops is that poor farmers can't save their seeds year after year. So is there anything in the works that, you know, I understand completely that you have a patent for farmers in the States, let's say they need to buy the seeds year after year, but what about farmers in Africa? I mean, are you thinking about possibly letting them save their seeds for a specific amount of time before they have to buy the seeds again?
Yeah, you may not have caught the beginning, but one of the things I talked about that I'm most proud about at the technology is that the vast majority of the farmers who are using biotechnology are outside the U.S., and the vast majority of them are small farmers in China and India and other parts of the world. Those farmers always have a choice whether they want to buy a biotech seed or any other seed. And the reason they pick the biotech seeds is that it creates incremental value. And maybe the best way of describing what I mean, the beauty of this science is you can take all of this advances in biology and genetic engineering and breeding and put it in a seed, and every farmer in the world knows what to do with the seed. So the barriers to adoption, the hurdles, are very, very low. And the ability to reap benefit is high. And, you know, the classic examples, if you go to India, where I helped to launch Bolgard Cotton, you know, just right after the U.S. and worked with several of the folks who are laureates in the World Food Prize, that technology has basically, you know, doubled yields in cotton. And when you think about what that means at a village level or at a grower level, you know, we're not talking a food crop here, but we're talking probably one of the most important cash-generating crops for a grower. And we've seen the same thing in Africa, where we've launched the technology in Burkina Faso and other countries. So the grower always has a choice between whether they want to use a biotech seed or another seed, but the decision to use the seed is based on the fact that it provides such great incremental value.
I have one more transatlantic question. Right now there are negotiations between the European Union and the U.S. government about a free trade zone, a common free trade zone. Do you see this maybe as a new chance to become more successful in the European Union, or do you think this is politically so poisonous we better stay out of this? And have you kind of given up on Europe?
Mark, have you given up on Europe?
Surely not.
If you say you had, I would answer it differently. But you know, so Europe is a challenge. But I also want to maybe just step back on Europe, because sometimes the you know, some of the obvious things aren't clear. Europe has granted regulatory approvals for every corner soybean product that's been developed around the world. And as you know, all of the corn and soybeans that are imported by European companies for use in their food and feed processes are from the U.S. and from Brazil and Argentina, which are all biotech. So the use of biotechnology products in food processing and animal feed is the mainstay of the feed industry. The focal point that we're talking about, just to be clear, is the ability of European farmers to plant the biotech seeds and get the benefits directly themselves versus having the grain, you know, coming in from the Americas. Right now, you know, there had been extensive plantings in Romania, in France, and particularly Spain and Portugal. Spain and Portugal are the only countries right now that are still allowing farmers to plant biotech corn seeds. And so the challenge becomes the ability of countries like France and Germany to change the policies that they put in place that today don't allow or favor regulatory approvals for planting. And, you know, I think we're seeing some really, really clear and direct statements out of, and Mark mentioned it, out of the British leaders who have taken a different view on the importance of science. And I would like to think that at some point this will change, but, you know, there's a lot of policies and politics that I don't understand. I mean, you have farmers that are highly compensated in Europe, as you well know. And at some point, I think the use of technologies that could even further reduce the environmental impact of what are today's non-biotech alternatives would be environmentally attractive. And I think the increased yields versus compensation payments would be attractive on a global basis in terms of world grain and market availability.
Well, that the science brings so much surprises that people will really change their mind, but there is a need to make a product that they can see it. By example, if the diseases here in Florida on oranges goes on, and if somebody rapidly would come up with a GM solution, I think everybody won't want his oranges. And this looks to the possibilities. But we should also, again, not be over-optimistic, because if you see in Hawaii the papaya, it was saved through the transgenics, and still people are protesting against GMOs, but papaya. So it's this absurdity we also have to realize. So that's why the communication, I'm afraid, and analyzes really what goes on in the mind of people and discuss that the same beliefs and fears that these people express to GMOs, that we also have it in our daily life for others, and that it is the same, and that we have to try to pay more attention to rationality and science. I think that would be a very important step to to do, and even our universities, the departments of sociology, will have to study how we organize our society and what our society problems are. If they would look how science, the experimental science, is sometimes handled, it would also be a progress.
I guess I'd end with a request. If anybody here wants any information on the 1,000-plus papers that establish the safety of this technology, I will be happy to give you my own personal edition of that. And I would hope to not see any more articles out of anybody here that says that this stuff isn't safe. So if we could reach an agreement there, that would help. The other thing you could do that would really help me a lot is, and this I'm being serious on, we know as a company we haven't done a good job of reaching consumers. We've been so focused on helping farmers that we now need to talk to consumers. And if there's forums or opportunities or interests you have, I'd love to follow up with you in terms of how we extend that dialogue in a way that matters. Thank you,
Dr. Tilton.
And my final comment is whether or not you're concerned about Rob's welfare or any company's welfare, I want you to be concerned in writing your articles about the welfare of the whole world, because there are going to be a lot of hungry people here. So as you write about this technology, I hope that you will give at least a balanced view of the safety, the utility of these biotech tools. They're great. They're fantastic, and we are going to need them, believe me.
Thank you very much. With that, I think we'll end today. I will remind you, we're running a little bit late because of the symposium schedule, but at about 3:15, we will have President Grimson from Iceland here in the press room. Thanks. Thank you.